Welcome to a quick Conversations of Change podcast with Dr. Jen Fram. We have a change chat with one of the leaders in the change management field. Hello, everybody. This week in our change chat, I've got the extreme pleasure of being able to speak with Daryl Connor. Now, I could speak for 3 to 5 minutes citing all of his, Daryl's accomplishments and bona fides, but, you know, that's going to cut into our time, so I'm going to leave that information in the blog post notes. Suffice to say, if you have ever used the burning platform metaphor, that's Daryl's work. If you've talked of the commitment curve in change, that's Daryl's work. And simply put, Daryl, or Dazza, as we know him here in Australia, is the Yoda of contemporary change management. And it's a true honour to have you on the show. Daryl, welcome to our change chat.
Thank you, Jen. I've been looking forward to us getting to have a little time together. So thanks for the invitation.
Oh, absolute pleasure. So first question, Daryl. After, 40 plus years at the coalface with Connor Partners Consulting, you've now moved away to a focus on developing high-impact practitioners with Connor Academy and working with NGOs in Connor Advisory. Can you tell us a bit about that shift? What was the impetus for it? What brought it about? How that's gone for you?
Sure. Moving. First of all, Connor Partners is still alive and well and moving forward, just with a lot less of my energy. I came back from giving a speech a few years ago, and the speech was about how our profession, it was to a large group of practitioners, and the speech was about how I thought we as a profession needed to be much more attentive and mindful, not just about being good at what we do, but about being attentive to where we do it, and that I feel like that, you know, change management either really makes a difference or it doesn't, and if it does make a difference, then we have some responsibility to apply it to what I defined as changes that matter. It is a broad definition, but I said, you know, a change that matters is a change that will actually have an impact on the human experience, not just profitability for a particular organization. Well, the speech was well received, but I came off the stage a bit destabilized by my own speech because I realized literally when I would, in the process of giving it, is that I wasn't at all confident that I was living up to the challenge that I was asking other practitioners to consider. And so I got in a plane, came back to Atlanta, and within a couple of days, I called the staff together and I said, I don't know exactly what I'm going to do, but I need to shift my energy into focusing on changes that matter at the level of humanity. And so over a little bit of time, that took two forms. Connor Advisory is a separate company that works exclusively with international NGOs. They dealing with no different, the same dynamics around executing large-scale change. And I work with the CEOs and the senior staffs in helping them get clear about their role. But what's at stake isn't profitability necessarily. It's really impact on humanity. It may be working with or work with Habitat for Humanity, so it may be building houses or Doctors Without Borders. Obviously medical care. There's just several different organizations that we work with, and it's just incredibly fulfilling to practice the craft in such a way so that the impact is at that broader human level. And so I thought about that's a way to serve leaders of changes that matter. And the other side, Connor Academy, was formed to work with practitioners, the people in our profession. Because when leaders that are really trying to make a difference through change, when they decide to be serious about it, they need to turn to those in our profession and for guidance. And sometimes that's an internal practitioner, sometimes it's an external consultant, but let's say to our professional field. And the focus of the academy is not about tools and techniques, because I think that our profession has plenty of options about methodologies and training for that. what I wanted to focus in on is not what we do, but who we are. What kind of character and presence do we bring to our work? So Connor Advisory works with international leaders of international organizations that are focused in on shifting the quality of life in some way for humanity, and change. And the Academy focuses in on practitioners, helping them move up to that mastery level where they're not just relying on the proficiency that they've developed around tools and techniques, but they're also relying on their character and presence and bringing that into the value stream for their clients.
It's, you know, that in terms of, you know, our change language, that's more than a step change in terms of where you've gone there. And it makes me curious. So that has been a big change, particularly for the people who you had previously working with in terms of Connor Partners. As an expert in change management, what surprised you about your own change process?
What a great question. I've never had that question before.
Yeah, see, I was under pressure for these questions.
The surprise, Janet, was I anticipated some grieving that didn't occur. you know, Connor Partners, I mean, I started Connor Partners in 1974, okay? So it's been the primary expression of, you know, personally and professionally who I am, and it, you know, it was just a wonderful platform. And so it's been so much part of my life that I anticipated really a sense of loss about it, that, you know, certainly it took some adjustment to me and others, and you know, I'm still involved. I mean, I still own the company, so it's not like I don't care, right?
Yeah.
But my energy, my focus has shifted. And so it was a bit of a surprise that there wasn't, there wasn't that kind of grieving. And I think two things probably contributed to it. Number one, Connor Partners didn't go away. It's still there. But number two, all of that energy around creating that I fed into Connor Partners all those years, that I had two new vessels to put that in. The Academy, where I get to work with just phenomenal, you know, we only accept really seasoned practitioners into these programs on the Connor Academy side. And so getting to work with professionals that are serious about change management and are ready to move to a mastery level, I mean, that what an honor, what a gift to do that. And then to have the privilege, and it's just a privilege to take our profession to leaders that are serious about making a difference in humanity. And so that I think I just was expecting there to be grief that didn't surface.
How interesting. Because that really... I guess one of the debates in the change space is over, you know, whether the Kubler-Ross cycle is appropriate, and we assume that everybody's going to go through shock, despair before they get to the good bit. And, you know, you've just provided a proof point there that not everybody does go through that.
Well, and by the way, I'm a real subscriber to that model. And, and just as a side note, I had a wonderful fortune of actually having some training by her.
Beautiful.
In an earlier part of my life. So I think it's a wonderful model, and how I have made sense out of it in my own experience is that nothing really went away. I just had an opportunity to expand without having to give up. That's the best I can make sense out of that. Why there wasn't. Now, I think that if Connor Partners disappeared and or I didn't have new vehicles to express myself and to try to, I see these particularly at the Academy as a way of not just servicing, supporting individual practitioners as they pursue mastery, but really to try to help the our profession evolve, and I think without those vehicles, it would probably be a very different story for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, in Raising Your Game, you make the distinction between high impact practitioners, those who are adequate, and those who are inept. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came about those distinctions, and what have been the implications of those categories?
Yeah, so um, I began a very informal, non-academic, non-rigorous research project a couple of years ago. I started asking consumers of change management what value they thought they were getting from our profession. By consumers, I mean leaders who either hired somebody full-time to be an internal change agent or hired a consultant. I started saying, what do you think? Are you getting your money's worth? And I got back some, as the patterns evolved, I got back some, I thought was some pretty sobering findings. 25% of the time, what I got back was, the question was, what value are you getting from working with your change practitioner? And 25% of the time, what I got back was, I'm not getting any value. Mm. This person is useless. I avoid them if I possibly can. I'm getting no value at all. 25% of the time. 65% of the time, what I heard was, I got no complaints. I asked for something. They give it to me. They do a good job. I don't expect a lot out of them. I don't consider them strategic resources. But if I have a tactical need, if I need some communications or some training, and I think that'll help. I think change management is fine. No complaints at all. 10% of the time, what I got back was this person. Sometimes it was a team there. Usually it was a person that I work with, again, inside or outside practitioner, didn't matter. This person is not a vendor. This is a partner with me. I would never go into a serious change project without this person being surgically attached to my hip. This is a true trusted advisor. Really amazing testimonials about these people. And by the way, they came from all, it didn't matter what discipline they were using, but it didn't matter what certification. I saw no pattern at all about the training they had gotten, but there was clearly this separation of those that they were having unusual levels of influence with their clients. No client is going to give you a carte blanche and do whatever you say, but these clients, they were deeply listening and valuing to the advice they got. So I got intrigued with that and wanted to better understand this distinction between what separates adequate from high impact, the 65% from the 10%. And as I crawled into that, I gained a further appreciation for the value that was being provided by the 65%er. So, Jim, as we talk about this, I want to be really careful that what I came out of this investigation with is it, by no means is there a pejorative spin here about the adequate practitioner. They're being asked for tactical work, and they're doing a good job of delivering tactical results. So, the inept is a whole different category. I wish that didn't exist, but. The adequate practitioner is doing a perfectly honorable job, and yet, I think it's important that we be honest with ourselves. There is 10% of our profession that is just having disproportionate kind of impact. And when I crawled into the separation between the two, yes, those in the 10% certainly were more proficient with their tools and techniques and methodologies. Yes, that was true. But that ended up not being the critical differentiator. The key differentiator was that adequate practitioners were bringing tools and techniques to the table. The 10% high impact were bringing tools and techniques and the uniqueness of their character and presence. And what I mean by that is adequate practitioners would spend, I found, a lot of time making sure nobody gets upset and you're not offended by the feedback, and let me make a little suggestion here. Boy, the 10% were not doing that. They were just in your face. This is what's going on. I don't mean in a disrespectful way, but they put very little attention to making sure everybody was comfortable. They were focused on creating value. And they did that by bringing the uniqueness of how they saw this information. They would bring wisdom, if you will, that didn't come out of just the tools and techniques. And so that helped me begin to shape this, excuse me, to shape this distinction between who we are as practitioners, and the shorthand for that is that's our methodologies. It doesn't matter what methodology we use. We all have one or two or three. That's who we are. That's what we do. Then there's who we are. And that's when we stand on our truth. Mm-hmm. And whatever our methodology has taught us is going on, that we actually are really honest with the client about that. And we bring real mitigation strategies to them, not just the ones they're comfortable with. We're brutally honest, all those sorts of things. Mastery isn't simply getting another certification. Mastery is taking our certifications and adding the uniqueness that we have to offer as individuals. And another finding that came out for me was when I would ask the adequate category, why aren't you being more honest? A lot of them said, yeah, well, I got a mortgage to pay and kids to go to school. And so it was a safety issue. Whereas the 10%, they felt like it's safer to be really honest with the client because clients want that kind of truth, at least the right kind of client. You can't be this way with every client, but if you match up with a client who not only wants somebody that knows tools and techniques, but wants somebody to be really truthful about what's going on and not put veneer on it, if you match up with that kind of client, the last thing they want to do is to get rid of a practitioner like that. So
yeah.
I found the 10% actually didn't feel like they were taking risk, whereas the 65% were afraid of taking risk.
Yeah, I think you're right there, because like if I think about when I face into those conversations which are difficult and one might think you need courage to have, when I frame it up with I do you an injustice and a disservice if I sugarcoat this, they seem quite comfortable with it, you know. I think it's to some extent it's about the intent that you have in delivering those messages. You know, is it in service of the client or is it in service of yourself, which sometimes the mortgage is what's holding you back and that's the intent behind it. It's fascinating.
That issue, Jen, that you were just mentioning, that the language we use in our profession is, you know, of course, we're all in service to our clients, right? Mm-hmm. And yet you look at our behavior, and much of our behavior as a profession is, yes, I'm here in service of the client. In the unspoken, then in quotes, is as long as I don't jeopardize my business, or as long as I can still pay my mortgage. So, in reality, what I'm saying is the client comes first, unless I'm at risk, and then I'm going to put myself first.
Yeah.
So even if the CEO hired me to find out what's going on in the organization, I've learned that he or she is actually at the epicenter of the problem. Now the issue is, am I going to be in service to the client and tell the CEO that, or am I going to be in service to me and find a way to water all that down and make sure that he or she doesn't get upset?
Yeah. Now, having you just mentioned the language that we use, and it prompted me, having done the Raising Your Game workshop with you, metaphors play a really big structural part in it. You're working the clay, playing your music, finding your fans, working on the, you know, revealing the inner sapling. Tell me a little bit about your relationship to metaphor. Has this always been an important modality for you in your change work?
Yeah, it has. I feel a bit apologetic about it because I seem to not be able to get through very many client conversations without inserting metaphors. It's always been, I think it's because, you know, at the heart of my work all these years, I'm a researcher. Now, it's field research, it's not academic research, but I've always been about trying to identify patterns of success and failure around change. I'm into research that can be applied. So I can't just come up with interesting findings. I've got to craft those in such a way so that a client can actually get practical value.
Yeah.
And what I learned early is simply feeding back data or findings from research, that doesn't help. But if I can craft those issues into a memorable story or a narrative or a metaphor that has more sticking power. You know, that you mentioned the burning platforms and the, mm-hmm. and the various things. People can remember images filled with content better than they can remember content mm-hmm. alone. And so I just early on just got really drawn to just watching a person or a crowd of people react to a story that they could see themselves in much differently than data that may or may not be so relevant for them.
Yeah, beautiful. Daryl, now I know there's potential for you to be coming back to Australia perhaps in around September for more of your Raising Your Game workshops. Tell us, in 2017, what's exciting you, besides potentially coming back to Australia, about the field of organizational change management?
Well, I got to say, that's high on my list because so last year I was there with just two wonderful cohorts. The cohorts for these workshops are very small. We only have 14 slots. And so there was one cohort in Melbourne and one in Sydney, and just unbelievably phenomenal practitioners coming together. So I'm looking forward to coming back in September and meeting with – this time I think we'll do one in New Zealand as well. So that's a big something that really has me energized. We've also, the Academy, we're not only conducting more workshops this year, and we've got them in South Africa, and we've already done some in Europe, but we're also moving into trying to address, you know, people are coming out of the workshop saying, you know, I've begun a journey of mastery and I want to keep it. So we're looking for ways to try to support that journey. I'm concerned about our profession in that it's become so focused on certification. Mm. And by the way, I support certification. I think we need that to stabilize, you know, the profession. So it's not an anti-certification, but most of the certification is about what you do, not who you are. And if mastery is the integration of not only what I do, but also who I am, there's got to be some place to go and foster that kind of introspective work. Mm. And so that's what these workshops are trying to provide. And so anyway, just the doing more workshops is a big energizer for me. We've got some add-on options for people to be able to go to after the initial workshop, just to help people continue on in this journey of mastery development. And then I got to say the nature of the work with the nonprofits and the international NGOs is very humbling. It's very mm-hmm. humbling. Over the years, I've gotten used to senior leaders granting me, you know, some credibility and moving in a direction that I would suggest around change. But what was at stake was profitability or market share or whatever. Not that that's unimportant, but in this zone to be a part of taking our profession and applying it to something that actually could have a qualitative difference in the life of our grandchildren. Mm. That I just feel really blessed by. And I'm mentioning all this about my passion for it, Jen, because I want to encourage other practitioners. You know, you don't have to work for a big NGO. You can find a local anybody. But to me, that it's not even a matter of whether it's a profit or nonprofit. What matters is what are they up to? What's the nature of this change? See, most of these 40 plus years that I worked, I didn't pay too much attention to what the change was going to do. I was trying to look for people who were serious about the change.
Yeah.
And you know, to my knowledge, I never helped with an unethical change, but I wasn't looking to focus myself on changes that would make a huge difference in the quality of life for people. For our profession to have that kind of impact, mm-hmm. I just, you know, it's there. It's there for us. So I encourage other practitioners to be looking for places. And, you know, you may not be as nuts as I am to, you know, to leave one arena and do this full time. But any part of your practice that can go to helping organizations patients make a difference in life as opposed to just profitability. I encourage people to think in those terms.
Oh, Daryl, I can't think of a better encouragement to the change community to be really focusing on what matters than what you've just shared with us. So, Daryl, it's been an absolute joy to have you as a guest on the Change Chat. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jen. It was really great to have some time with you.
If you enjoyed this Change Chat, then do share with your colleagues and friends. You can find more at conversationsofchange.com.au, at Jen Fram on Twitter, or Conversations of Change on the Facebook.